Greetings to everyone around the world. We are in the middle of Sagadawa, the auspicious month. So let's begin this session with a brief meditation to set our intention in the right state. So with that brief mindfulness session, to wish that this session be beneficial to both oneself and others, I want to welcome Claus. Really great honor and pleasure to have you with us, because you are a real scholar authority on Buddha nature. And we have been having this event, this forum, to exchange ideas, to stimulate thoughts on Buddha nature, to promote the concept, the whole sort of ethos of Buddha nature, in order to also help the world have some sort of positive thinking, to help the world explore sort of meaning in life, and sort of see the good nature and the good side of things. So it's really great to have you with us to talk about Buddha nature in the Indo-Tibetan tradition, particularly from the perspective of the work you have done on the Buddha nature sort of proponents from the 14th and the 15th century Tibet. But before we get into the actual conversation, I often ask our guests to share with us your experience of first coming across this idea or this philosophy of Buddha nature, and what kind of impression or memory you have of that encounter.
Well, first of all, hello, everybody, and thank you very much for your kind words, Markus Peermann, and for your introduction, Karma Pünzog. It's a great honor to be here and to be able to share my research and also my preliminary experience in this format. And interesting, you know, like when I was thinking about, you know, like how it all started, it all happened in the year 1984, when I started to study Tibetology and Indology at the University of Bonn. And the Kamala Shila Institute was not very far. And so I had a chance to study a lot with traditional masters. And they visited the Kamala Shila Institute very frequently. And it was the Dagpo Thakyan, of course, you know, which was studied very much. We had the Duden by Kenpo Tsulten Gyamtso. And so that was my first encounter with Buddha nature. You all probably are familiar with the Dagpo Thakyan, and it starts by, well, the course is that you have a Buddha nature, and then, you know, like, okay, you meet a spiritual friend and you set out on the path. And I thought, well, that's great, you know, like, I mean, I have a Buddha in me, or at least a potential to become a Buddha. And now, like, I meet the masters, you know, from Tibet and from the exile in India. And now, you know, like, there's a community, and I can just embark on the path. And so that was somehow the beginning. And the 80s in the Kamala Shila Institute, I mean, that was a really active time. I mean, there were just one high Rinpoche coming after the other and giving very precious teachings, and like not only philosophical teachings, but there were a lot of empowerments. I mean, like a few weeks, you know, like after I had first visited Kamala Shila Institute, Kalu Rinpoche was giving a Kala Chakra empowerment, and you know, and then shortly after, Tenga Rinpoche came and gave a lot of teachings and the tantric empowerment. And it all somehow linked very well with this kind of teaching of Buddha nature, because like the tantric teachings are such powerful means, you know, to grant you a direct access to this Buddha nature and give you a glimpse at least of what Buddha nature feels like. Or so that was a very nice start in a way. And it was very precious also, because at that time, like, academic studies in Buddhism were not so strong and not so well informed. And Even though like the philological training was very good, you know, like teaching Sanskrit and Tibetan and all that, and it gave a very strong foundation. But you know, as for the understanding of the teaching, it was a nice opportunity, a good opportunity for me to complement my academic studies with traditional teaching and traditional upbringing, so to say. So that was basically how it started. And I mean, there's a very long story about it. And but I somehow ended up, you know, like working on, maybe I can just say that I happened to discover Gyulotsava Shenupel's extensive commentary on the Gyul Lama in the private library of Chitsang Rinpoche in India. And then, you know, like I got another copy that was a handwritten copy. Then I got a Parma or a block print from Dzogchen Pendlop Rinpoche. And based on that, I could like prepare a critical edition and I could translate the major parts of it and study Gyulotsava. And that's how I got interested in the 14th and 15th century. And I compared Gyulotsava with other masters of this time.
Fascinating, really amazing. I particularly find the powerful statement of Kampopa, the cause is Buddha nature. I think it's extremely influential and very powerful. Yeah, exactly. And then Gyulotsava's commentary, which I actually have discovered only recently, is probably the longest commentary on the ultimate continuum, Gyul Lama. It's so extensive. And we'll come to that later. But now you ended up working on these 14th, 15th century masters who had a lot to say on Buddha nature. And Buddha nature, obviously, is such a complex topic when you go into these commentaries. So in order to understand Buddha nature, especially for our audience who may not be all familiar with this, you have kindly shared a handout. So I'd like you to give your understanding of Buddha nature using this handout so that people can follow the discussions we will have about different interpretations as we proceed. So let me share screen first. Let me know.
Perfect. So I just like give you a short summary of the major doctrinal developments in India, because you understand much better the discussion on the topic of Buddha nature in the 14th and 15th century when you have these small pieces of information just in front of you. So if you can just download it, or like we will put it up later on the website, you know, like, or you just have a look. I will go in a few minutes through that. And I start with a group of sutras where Buddha nature is fully equated with ultimate truth and the Dhammakaya, like the Anunatva Apurna. And now I don't see the handout anymore.
Hold on. Sorry.
Now it's back.
There is a
Srimala Devi Sutra in the Kanchur. It equates Buddha nature with the Dhammakaya. Even the Dhammakaya, like which is free from stains. So like it's a full equation of Buddha nature with the Buddha. That means, you know, like we are already fully developed Buddhas in our within, and we simply don't know it. We are just obstructed by adventitious stains. And there is no growth of qualities or something. And we already have all Buddha qualities fully developed. I mean, that's what a number of sutras say. Like also Mahaparinirvana, Mahasutra, and the Srimala Devi, the Anunatva, and they say that this Dhammakaya with which the Buddha nature is equated is permanent, it's blissful, it's the Atman, it's pure. So like when you're a little bit like familiar with Buddhist philosophy, well, you might like sense that there is a problem, you know, that call the ultimate or Buddha nature or Dhammakaya an Atman. And there were quite a few other like mainstream Indian Buddhists who had problems with that. And so we find in other sutras and other texts, like different approaches or strategies to interpret like this full equation of Buddha nature with grown Buddha and in the terms that we have an Atma and everything. And one is the Lankavatara, which equates emptiness with Buddha nature, and the Alaya Vijnana, even though one probably has to say like the emptiness in the Lankavatara is not like the emptiness of Chandrakirti, is the great emptiness of ultimate meaning. Then, you know, like another important text is the Mahayana Sangraha. That's now not a sutra anymore. That's a shastra, like a treatise. And why do I name it here? Well, because it distinguishes here Alaya Vijnana from the enlightenment of the Buddha. So like we have one group like which equates Buddha nature with the Alaya Vijnana, and another one, well, the Mahayana Sangraha doesn't use the word Buddha nature, but it speaks of the enlightenment of the Buddha. So you could say like it clearly like distinguishes Buddha nature from the Alaya Vijnana. The difference is such that while the Lankavatara somehow says that like there is no difference, it's like Buddha nature and Alaya Vijnana is like the ocean and the waves, you know, like the waves are the water of the ocean, there is no real difference. Like the Mahayana Sangraha would say, no, like the Alaya Vijnana is completely separate from the Buddha. And when you, for example, study and listen and reflect and meditate on the Dharma, the seeds of this positive activity is not stored in your Alaya Vijnana, but it is stored in the Buddha mind, which pervades the whole world and also us sentient beings. So that's a very clear cut distinction. So that's something you have to remember. And then I just wanted to give you the main like information from the standard Indian treatise on Buddha nature, the Ratnagotra Vibhaga. And it gives, you know, the three reasons why we have a Buddha nature. You know, like first, the Buddha wisdom like is present in all sentient beings. The second reason is the non-duality of stainlessness, which means, you know, like the true nature, the tatata, or the emptiness of our mind as an ordinary being is not different from the emptiness of a Buddha. So it's a kind of restriction of this full equation of a Buddha nature in a sentient being with a fully grown Buddha. Like it's only equated on the level of emptiness. So it's like saying, you know, the chair and the table in front of me, they are not different because they are both empty of an own nature. So that's a very like, restricted form of equation. And then, you know, that's like very important. The third reason is its fruit, I mean, the Buddhahood has been metaphorically applied to the potential, rather the Buddha nature is the cause here. Upachara, metaphorically applied, can also mean, you know, a manner of speech. So you can translate this sentence also, its fruit is a manner of speech for the potential. So like that means the potential is vaguely called a Buddha, even though the Buddha nature with its inseparable qualities is not yet purified. And then, you know, like that, you can imagine that like some, you know, like prefer, you know, to see like the first interpretation and say like Buddhahood has been metaphorically applied to the potential. And they establish a difference, you know, like between the potential and the fully grown Buddha. Whereas others, they insist like upachara means only a manner of speech and stick to the full equation. So like either way, you can interpret the third reason such. Then, you know, like I wanted to show you also another verse from the Ratnagotra Vibhaga. It goes like, just as all pervading space is not defiled because of its subtle nature, so is this Buddha nature, which is found everywhere in sentient beings. Now, like you find the same sentence again in the Bhagavad Gita, and instead of tata ayam, like this very brackets Buddha nature, you have tat atma. So in the Bhagavad Gita, instead of Buddha nature, you have Atman. So I'm showing you that, you know, like just to indicate how close like the teaching of a Buddha nature, even in the Ratnagotra Vibhaga, even in India Shastra, is to the non-Buddhist teaching of an Atman. Yeah. And maybe we just go down a little bit. I try to be short now. And Well, there is just this like standard like definition of Buddha nature. Nothing needs to be removed from it and nothing needs to be added. Yeah. And well, that has been interpreted also in different ways. We will come back to that. And then, you know, like there is this following verses which question, you know, like, why did the Buddha teach here Buddha nature exists in all sentient beings after they taught everywhere that everything should be known to be empty in every respect, like clouds in dreams and illusions and so on. So like here comes the question, you know, how comes, you know, like you have this notion of an ultimate Buddha nature in all sentient beings when it has been already said in the Prajnaparamita that everything is empty. And that has been interpreted in different ways. And there is a Madhyamaka tradition which establishes that based on these two verses, Buddha nature is neata, has a provisional meaning. And then you have also Yogacara hermeneutics, which establishes with their own principles on the basis of the very same verses that Buddha nature teaching has definitive meaning. So that was my overview. And you can see now, you have the situation in India such that, well, you can fully equate Buddha nature with a Buddha, even to the extent that you can say, well, there is a permanence and there is bliss, there is an Atman and everything. But you can also say, well, Buddha nature is only a potential and it naturally grows. You can equate it, you can take it as a synonym with emptiness and align it with Madhyamaka. Then you can also take the whole Buddha nature teaching as a teaching of provisional meaning. And you can take it, you know, also as a teaching of definitive meaning. And I'm telling you all that because in fact, in the 14th and 15th century Tibet, you find a master for every possible combination of these. So when we discuss, you know, now the different masters of the 14th and 15th century, I think it's quite helpful to have this handout on the side.
Indeed, yes. Thank you. Thank you for sharing this very good overview, and especially all the critical texts that are subject to different interpretations. And I think by bringing in even the Bhagavad Gita verse, you sort of underscore how difficult the philosophy or the concept of Buddha nature is, because there's been so much controversy around it, of it being almost non-Buddhist, sort of eternalistic philosophy on one hand, and then the other saying that this is the ultimate truth that the Buddha taught. So we have this really complex situation of whether we see Buddha nature teachings as you said, provisional teachings or ultimate teachings, as Buddha nature as being absolute real nature in sentient beings with full-blown Buddha qualities, or just the potential to bring about those qualities. So when you look at, for instance, as a student, when I want to understand somebody's position on Buddha nature, I often go to these verses and check how they interpreted these verses. Because I think these verses are critical sort of core texts on which they give their commentaries and thereby show their position. So when you look at the 14th century, for instance, Claus, there are so many authors. It's unbelievable that there's so much scholarship, and also most of the highly authoritative Tibetan philosophers and authors on Buddha nature lived in the 14th century, were active in the 14th century, and then also some of them, of course, in 15th century. If you look at, firstly, the 14th century, I don't know if you would have time to even go with all the masters from one of these centuries, but if you look at the people who were active in 14th century, who have you studied and who do you find very sort of persuasive, convincing, and impressive in terms of their interpretation of Buddha nature? I think earlier you cited Gampopa, and to me, one of the people in the Gaju tradition following Gampopa is Rangjung Dorje.
Yeah, exactly. So this was also one of the first masters I, of course, studied, and the Kamapas and the third and the seventh and the eighth Kamapas. I found them particularly interesting, and And then, like, of course, you know, like in the following centuries, there were quite interesting masters also, like in the Rime movement, you know, like Contre l'Autre Taille and so on. And then, of course, you know, like I got also somehow fascinated by the Zhunang teaching. So maybe it had to do something with that. My first empowerment was a Zhunang Kalachakra empowerment. Somehow I ended up also having a kind of a special relation now with the Zhunang past. In fact, we have a research project with the Zhunang masters in Amdo since 2019, and we are studying the Kalachakra Tantra and how it is used to support the Shantong view. And so, yeah, of course, Dalpopa and his disciples are very exciting also, you know, in this period. Yeah, and then there was,
I read somewhere that Dalpopa met Rangjung Dorje, and perhaps it is because of that connection that they share.
But it is rather that Dalpopa, first of all, was not upholding a Shantong view. It is said that, like, after he met Rangjung Dorje, that he became a Shantong Pa. But there are also other stories, you know, like that it was based on his own experience, you know, like while in Kalachakra retreat. Which is also possible in a way, but it's difficult to say. Yeah. In any case, he was the most prominent teacher of Zhunang Buddha nature understanding. And it's very interesting and fascinating to study also this approach. Yeah.
But it's also interesting in that the Kalachakra teachings, at least the canonical ones, do they mention the term Tathagata Garbha? I don't think they do, right? But then
one has to say first, you know, like as when it comes to research, when you research Buddha nature, I mean, there is one thing, you know, like you just look for all the Gyulama commentaries and then you search all like the terms Buddha nature. But, you know, like I soon discovered it doesn't lead you anywhere. I mean, you don't find out very much. And it's sometimes even misleading, you know, like, for example, when you read Dalpopa's Gyulama commentary, and he has written it in a very traditional way, such that the Buddha qualities are produced through the accumulation of merit. Yeah. And so you're surprised. Well, I mean, he's supposed to say that they primordially exist, you know, and so they should be there. But when you read like his Rigi Nidan, you find a distinction between an ordinary presentation and an extraordinary tantric presentation. So what Dalpopa did, you know, like when he was interpreting a sutra, he was just, you know, like giving the common interpretation of the Gyulama, and the extraordinary Shantong view, he disclosed only when he gave tantric teachings. So like to understand and study Dalpopa, looking at his Gyulama commentary doesn't help at all. Mm-hmm. So what I'm saying is, you know, like when you study the view of a master on Buddha nature, you have to study his hermeneutics. You have to study his whole system. You see, I mean, the text itself, the Gyulama, it's very simple, you know, like, I mean, you know, everybody has a Buddha inside, and, you know, like the verses are not so difficult to understand, right? But, you know, like for a master, like he's not only to interpret Buddha nature, but he has his whole teaching, you know, like of the three Dhamma chakras. He has the first, the second Dhamma chakra. They are all the Prajnaparamita sutras. They are the Madhyamaka texts. There is Chandrakirti. There is Dharmakirti. There is, you know, like lots of different tenets and philosophical ideas. And if you take like the whole Tenshuru as a commentary on the Buddha word, yeah, which every traditional master is doing, then as commentaries on the three Dhamma chakras, then, you know, like you have to organize all these complex different ideas and philosophies in a consistent system of teaching, of doctrine. And that's the challenge, you know, to identify what is a master up to, you know? Does he prefer Chandrakirti, you know, like or, you know, like, is he rather, you know, a follower of Kamala Shila? You know, does he prefer a combination of Yogacara and Madhyamaka? Or is he like only following Yogacara, which is not very often in Tibet? I mean, there was Ratnakarashanti, but, or is he like doing something completely outrageous, like the Chonangpas, you know, like,
like just, yeah. In Dorpopa's case, I suppose his ritual, the mountain dharma, is the magnum opus on his Shentong or view of other emperors, isn't it? It's such a superb, very substantive, amazingly authoritative text. And then he proposes these theories of Madhyamika in a very drastic way compared to other scholars of his time or before. You think that is done mostly in the context of his understanding of Tantra, such as Kalachakra?
I think, you know, like Kalachakra is really important. And I started to realize this after working with Chonang masters. And it has different reasons here. One of them is like that, like you have the concept of Adi Buddha, right? Of So that nicely establishes that all Buddha qualities are primordially existent. Whereas, you know, when you look at the Gulama, like there are different sets of qualities. You know, you have the qualities of the Dharmakaya, you have the qualities of the form kayas, you have the Swabhavika kaya, different sets. And, you know, like not all of them are said to exist primordially, you know, like some say, well, you know, like the qualities of the 32 qualities of the Dharmakaya, like the 10 strength and so on, they exist primordially, but not, you know, the like 32 marks of a body and the 80 like secondary marks. And so, but you know, like when you say, well, there's an Adi Buddha, you know, there is a primordial Buddha, there is no more question about this. You know, it just means all qualities are already there, and not only as a potential, but fully there. And then, you know, like you have this concept in the Kalachakra of Kongsuk, and which is often like mistranslated as empty forms. You know, like when you look at the Sanskrit, it's shunya bimba or shunyata bimba, and bimba doesn't mean form, it means reflection. And it's compared to the reflection in a magical divination mirror, and in which a virgin can see, for example, in a supernatural way, a thief or something, and or can do some predictions about the future, or she can help you to trace back some lost items, you know, some magical thing, you know, it's kind of supernatural appearance. So, and the idea is that like once, like you have in the Shadanga Yoga made all the winds enter the central channel, and you know, the normal perceptions subside, and you don't have any more like visual or anything else, you know, like no subject object duality anymore. And you are doing this also in a dark room, you know, in a munkang. Then, you know, like you all of a sudden have this like manifestations or reflections of emptiness. And they are not like conceptually created, because normally whenever we see something, it comes from our own abhuta parikalpa, from our false imagining. But this, they just come from space themselves. And that means, you know, like for the Chonangpas, that means, you know, like the emptiness or the space, you know, it's full of qualities. And that supports their Shantung view in a very, very nice way. And so I think, you know, like there are reasons for them to follow the Kalachakra.
Yeah, and also the Kalachakra in Tibet has been praise for being so explicit and emphatic in the in revealing the innate nature, the
exactly
word performance in it.
Yeah, even though, you know, like the Gelugpas, they have a completely different understanding of it. And I'm only saying that it you can have also a Prasangika interpretation of the Kalachakra, and it also makes perfect sense. You know, like but you know, like the Chonangpas, they really, like by taking a lot of passages literally, they have good support in the Kalachakra for their Shantung view. Yeah.
So now when you look at other the other stream of Buddha nature thought, living at the same time, as contemporaries of Dalpopa, you have Bhutan almost coming with the same background. Perhaps just difference would be the Kalachakra meditation or right. focus on Kalachakra. And he had a very different interpretation of Buddha nature. How do you understand that?
Bhutan well, I mean, you know, like Bhutan and together with a number of other scholars who obviously prefer Madhyamaka, like so their main hermeneutic strategy is to follow the second Dharma chakra. So the second Dharma chakra has definitive meaning, and so the third Dharma chakra only has provisional meaning. And you can do that, you know, I have shown you on the handout. So based on the Gyulama, you can prove that, like if you apply Madhyamaka hermeneutics, you can show it has niyata. And for him, you know, it's a kind of easy way out. Yeah, because he simply doesn't try to like rephrase or reinterpret a lot of verses. He doesn't like, he doesn't try to explain away the Atman stuff and, you know, like the full equation. And so he simply like leaves everything just as it is. And he said, well, but it's niyata. So it's one way of dealing with it, you know, like, and I mean, there are other ways, you know, like of being a Madhyamaka and be more accommodating towards the Gyulama. And maybe I should talk about that also, or
please share how.
Okay, so like you see, like there's like Nolodin Sherab. He's a very important figure. He lived in the second half of the 11th century. He was a translator also of the Gyulama into Tibetan, and he had written a Duden, a summary of the Gyulama. And studying that is quite enlightening. And he, for example, says that Buddha nature is just a non-implying negation. It's a kind of emptiness. And but you know, like it differs a little bit from the Geluk understanding. He says, well, it's beyond the reach of the intellect, you know, it cannot be like grasped, so to say, but you know, like basically it's a negation, it's a Madhyamaka negation. And or if you want to have it in a simple way, he just equates it with emptiness. And just to give you an example what he does, like you have this verse, you know, like nothing needs to be added, you know, to the Buddha nature, and nothing needs to be removed. So he says, nothing needs to be added to the cause of Buddha nature. It just fits in a small syllable, you know, in his commentary, and he changes the meaning completely. You know, like the cause of Buddha nature would be emptiness of mind. So you concentrate, you meditate on the emptiness of mind, and then, you know, like the qualities, they come as if called, as if summoned, you know. So by meditating on the nature of mind, which is emptiness, and the fact that the mind is empty by nature and can be changed, so to say, because it is empty, the qualities just come, you know, together with this realization of mind's emptiness. So the qualities are created. But he interprets, you know, this verse, nothing needs to be removed and nothing needs to be added, such that, you know, like you don't need to add anything to the cause of Buddha nature. You don't need to add anything to emptiness. Your mind has always been empty throughout beginningless time. Yeah, nothing needs to be added to that. And that's all you need, you know, because your mind is empty. You can meditate on it and you can create the qualities. And the adventitious stains, they have never existed in the first place. So there's nothing to be removed. So you see, like, this is what Nolodin Sherab does. And because he's having this kind of more complicated or sophisticated interpretation, he can claim that the Buddha nature teaching has definitive meaning. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, like, and this is somehow also an approach you can find again in the Geluk interpretation. There is a commentary on the lecture in Ningpo by Gungtang Champeyang. And he explains, you know, like these two verses which point out a contradiction between Buddha nature and Prajnaparamita. Of course, you know, they first of all directly point out a kind of problem, yeah, because there's a contradiction. But indirectly, that's what Gungtang Champeyang says, it also implies that if Buddha nature teaching is the same as the Prajnaparamita teaching, there would be the fault of redundancy. So if Buddha nature is just emptiness, then why to repeat the teaching, why to say it again? Well, and then, the answer would be, well, we have to teach emptiness again, making use of the word Buddha nature in order to counteract the five faults, which are to be discouraged and so on, So people might be discouraged and lose hope. So you tell them, well, there's a Buddha inside you, so please practice, there is hope for you. So in order to counter this faults, teach emptiness by making use of the word Buddha nature. And because Buddha nature is understood as a synonym for emptiness, you can say that the Buddha nature teaching has definitive meaning. So that's the two main approaches by those who take Buddha nature as a synonym of emptiness, or who explain away Buddha nature as a provisional teaching.
But Claus, even in the case of mainstream Gelugpas, starting with Tsongkhapa, wouldn't they identify Buddha nature with emptiness, that is non-implicative negation? And then that emptiness is considered as an ultimate truth, isn't it? As nitartha. That qualities of Buddha are in you already, that particular teaching may be nyartha or provisional, but Buddha nature is empty.
But what they basically say is, if you study the Gyulama, it's teaching that Buddha nature is the mind empty of an inherently existing mind. And by meditating on this non-implicative negation, the qualities just appear. So they follow somehow Nolo and Sherab and say, this is how we understand the Gyulama. So if you want, it's not taking the Gyulama anymore literally. And then, if you reinterpret the Gyulama as Nolo and Sherab is doing it, then you can call it definitive meaning. I mean, the result is the same, either, you just take it literally and say it's niyata, or you reinterpret it and then you say it's nitata. So the effect is that you don't accept Buddha nature, right?
It's almost 40 minutes past our conversation. Let's see if there are any questions from the audience. If there's anyone who has a question, Marcus, any questions on Facebook?
Not many questions yet. We have one question on Facebook coming in. So I encourage anyone who would like to ask a question to do so on the Q&A function on Zoom. But from Facebook, we see one question. Is Buddha nature actually explainable? Or is it an experience-based understanding? Does our dualistic mind have the capacity to understand Buddha nature correctly?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And usually, one has to say it's in the realm of experience. I mean, there is Asanga's commentary as an introduction to the verses which I just quoted on the handout. And it says, what is the purpose of teaching Buddha nature? If even 10th level bodhisattvas cannot fully grasp it. Yeah, so if it's even difficult for those who will be a Buddha very soon, so why, teach it? And, that shows that it's really a kind of teaching very difficult to grasp. And, it can be only assessed directly in a way, and it is given as a teaching to encourage people. Yeah. So even though you are not at the moment able to directly experience your Buddha nature, but just to reassure you, you know, like, don't worry, you know, you have this Buddha in you, and there will be a result, you know, if you practice the path. But then, you know, like the Buddha nature teaching becomes more accessible, like in Mahamudra or in Dzogchen or in Tantra, when you get like a privileged access to the true nature, either through formal tantric empowerment, yeah, or through a kind of mind-to-mind transmission. Yeah, and that's something this is a speciality of the Kagyu teachings, so to say. But it's definitely something else than the intellectual understanding of absence of inherent existence, or like when you're doing inferences and you're using logic to establish that things are empty of an inherent nature. This is not the same experiential sphere than the direct access. And Gelotsava, we had no chance up to now to talk about Gelotsava, but
he's
doing that, you know, like he says, well, you know, like there is this kind of direct access to Buddha nature, and he calls it Riktong, so kind of awareness emptiness. And he inherits this tradition from Maitripa, and he quotes again and again Maitripa, and so that's, by the way, also why I got very much interested in Maitripa. And as a follow-up project after my Buddha Nature project, I studied Maitripa because it's giving a kind of possibility of direct access to this Buddha nature, because I exactly had the same question, and also what is the point if it is not accessible? Why should I worry, you know, like I got interested in means, you know, to access. I started to get interested in these shortcuts, you know, to cut through into the Buddha nature. And Maitripa says, you know, like phenomena are luminous as experienced in Yata Buddha Samadhi, in the Samadhi which realizes reality as it truly is. So yeah, you can analyze like the phenomena as being empty, as non-arising and so on, but you can experience them also like as luminous by nature. And so the difference is such, like, there's a kind of practical thing also to it. Let's say you experience pain, you know, you go to a dentist and you have some painful experiences. Now the ordinary sutra approach would be, well, you analyze the emptiness of the pain and you just think, oh, like it arises from causes and conditions. It has no inherent existence. And after some time, it will go away again. When the causes and conditions are not there anymore, then the pain will also go away. I mean, that's one way of dealing with the situation. But Maitripa, you know, like he would just say, okay, I just experienced directly the luminous nature of the pain. And this way, you know, like you experience the pain as something blissful or as something. So you can directly experience, you know, like the qualities of the Dharmakaya, yeah, which are blissful and so on. And even though Maitripa doesn't use very much the term Buddha nature, but he gives very much the doctrinal basis for it. And by the way, also like Maitripa is said to have rediscovered the Gyulama. And Gelotsava says that like, because, you know, like Maitripa got the Mahamudra realizations through the Mahasiddha Shavaripa, he brought this doctrine of the Gyulama to life. You know, he like really made the Gyulama shine forth. Mm-hmm. And that means, you know, like he is kind of experiencing what he's teaching. So like Buddha nature is taught in a way that you can have direct access to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, perhaps also to respond to that question, it'd be good to know that there are two sort of general lineages associated with Buddha nature studies in Tibet. One that's more sort of exegetical or scholarly, and the other that is more experiential and meditative. And if you look at the scholarly tradition, then obviously some interpret it as a potential for Buddhahood, as an emptiness. And in those cases, I suppose you could claim that you can have first the conceptual understanding and then gradually have the direct experience. But in the experiential lineage, both among the Kadampas and Kagyupas, there seem to be some focus on the direct experience of Buddha nature. And Gyalsawa, who you have studied so well, he seemed to bring together these two components, or these He's both analytical and also very experiential. He quotes Gampopa, he quotes Dampa Sanghe, he quotes Digung Chamgen. So is that a unique feature of his among the Buddha nature authors? I mean, you have studied him. If you can talk a bit more.
Yeah, sure. Well, it's, yeah, Gyalsawa was a kind of unique, that's for sure. And one thing is that, historically speaking, he just lived in a time when the Yuan dynasty, after the Yuan dynasty, lost its power, and the Sakya, could not suppress anymore, the other schools in Tibet. And the thing is that the Sakya Pandita and other Sakyapas, they have criticized the Kagyu school very much. And they have criticized Kagyu Mahamudra for teaching Chinese Buddhism, Chinese Sokchen, and it has no Indian roots, you can have Mahamudra only after empowerment and Kirim and Sokrim creation and completion stage practice. And to teach Mahamudra in the way you do, Kagyus do, has no Indian roots. And now Gyalsawa was one of the first scholars, Kagyu scholars, who responded to this critique. And he embedded this critique in his Gyalsawa commentary. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing, And so he had an agenda, and the agenda was to show that there is Sutra Mahamudra. You can practice Mahamudra, this kind of direct approach to your true nature of mind, based on the sutras. And he reads, Mahamudra teachings into the Gyalsawa. So he weaves, Mahamudra together with the Gyalsawa, with the Buddha nature teaching. And that makes his commentary unique in a way. Of course, it has also other aspects. It has also the analytic approach and everything. But this direct approach, you find basically only in Gyalsawa. And then in the works of the masters, he quotes. When you go back to Maitripa and his disciples, and I'm going to bring out soon a new book on Maitripa in the lives of the masters, and you can very nicely read that.
Then you congratulations. Can,
yeah, and you can just see, that from a very early level on, you can work with his direct experiences. And Gyalsawa gives also some doctrinal support. So he says is according to the Vairochana Abhisambodhi Tantra, there are some kind of provisional path. You have the normal, the path of accumulation, the path of preparation, and the path of seeing and so on. And normally you can have a direct non-conceptual access to the true nature only from the first Bodhisattva level onwards. But the Vairochana Abhisambodhi Tantra says, but they are kind of preliminary, a path. And you can have a kind of provisional path of seeing already well below, on the path of accumulation. And so he argues, he quotes different passages which show that you can work already with direct access to the Buddha nature right from the beginning as a practitioner. And that makes it very special in a way.
Yeah, yeah, and I think we've touched on people working or who have been advocating other emptiness. We've touched also on scholars advocating self-emptiness, on direct experience of Buddha nature through the Kagyu tradition. Another tradition and scholar of this period is Longchenpa, who is one would also say had advocated direct experience of Buddha nature and Buddha nature's connection to Dzogchen, isn't it?
Yeah, right. By the way, Rangchung Dorje also, you can see a Dzogchen influence in his writings.
Yes.
And in his Sabmo Nangidön, he has this kind of Rigpa, you know, like the nature of mind, the mate, and he speaks of Novo and Rangshin, and you can see terminology from Dzogchen has mm-hmm. entered also his teachings, and mm-hmm. In the case of Longchen Rabchampa, it's what I did. I carefully studied the Tumta Tzu. It's one of the collections, the treasures written by Longchen Rabchampa. He wrote so much, you know. But this text is very interesting and very telling about his strategy. And he gives, you know, the sutra approaches, the tenets of the sutras. He goes through Vaibhashika, Sautrantika, and then Yogacara and Madhyamaka. And first, you know, when you read this text, you find that particular Dzogchen terms like Rigpa or Charshi, you know, the ground which of manifestation and so on, or Ying, you know, the sphere, they are equated with terminology of the Yogacara, for example, yeah, the Yongdrop, or other terms, you know, they are equated with Dzogchen terminology. And then there is one big chapter on the practice of the Mahayana, the non-tantric Mahayana. And there he basically gives a commentary on the Gyulama. And, you know, again, you know, when he teaches the Gyulama, he weaves in terminology from the Dzogchen into Gyulama commentaries. And then, you know, when he teaches Dzogchen, then he goes back to the, and he brings in again, you know, the Gyulama terminology, and people have already accepted that the terms mean the same. And then he gets, this way he gets a doctrinal support for his Dzogchen view on the basis of the Gyulama. So Buddha nature theory is very important for him. And he did also a few tricks which you may not recognize if you're not careful. He says, for example, that the qualities, the Buddha qualities, are luntrop, spontaneously present. But the Gyulama doesn't say that. It just says that the Buddha activity is luntrop. So, you know, he's a little bit, and I'm not saying cheating, but, you know,
But so I suppose Lundrup in the Dzogchen context has a slightly different connotation compared to the Lundrup that's used in the Gyulama.
Probably. Perhaps. Yeah, that's what I
more about spontaneous.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's basically what I said, you know, Of course, you know, I don't want to, it's only when I analyze, you know, I can see that, there are some scholars, you know, who just really carefully distinguish sutra from tantra. Mm. And when they are on the sutra level, they avoid any kind of tantric connotation. Mm. But Longchen Rabchampa was kind of bringing these two together and introducing.
Let's take another question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sure, there's several more questions. Yeah. Here's another question from Christian Share. Hi, Christian. Why is Buddha nature considered as a bridge between sutra and tantra? Is it because of its emphasis on bringing the fruit on the path?
Yeah, that's also a very good question. I thank you very much for that, because it allows me to elaborate on a few other aspects of tantric practice. When you do the completion stage and then the kind of experience you get, you know, based on the Buddha nature teaching, it feels like you relax into something which has always been there, you know, this blissful state and luminous and spacious state is a kind of your nature, and you relax into it, and it doesn't feel like it's something created from scratch. And I think this is a very important aspect to tantric practice, to have that. And also, when it comes to creation stage, when you create or generate the visualization of the deity, then, you know, like if you take the deity as a manifestation of Buddha nature, I think, you know, the generation stage practice becomes more powerful this way. Because, you know, you just like let something happen, which is already there anyway. So it just manifests. You just have to give it a little bit of concentration and it works. Whereas, you know, the mandalas and the deities and everything, they are just purely created, you know, as some Madhyamakas would have it, then it's a different tantric practice, I would say. I mean, and I think, you know, at least in the Kagyu tradition and Nyingma and Chonang, this is something very important for Tantra.
Mm.
But mm. I have to admit also that you can, of course, you know, practice Tantra and have a tantric theory without Buddha nature ideas. I mean, it of course works also with Prasangika Madhyamaka. You just have dependent origination and emptiness, that's all you need. And all the means, you know, all the mandalas and the bliss and everything, the chakras, they are just part of this dependent arising and, you know, a kind of useful visualization, which helps, you know, to create certain states of mind, with the help of which you can easily realize emptiness. So it, you know, when you read a Gelug interpretation or commentary on tantric practice, it also makes perfect sense. I don't want to denigrate that. It's only that, as a follower of Kagyu tradition, I just appreciate, you know, Buddha nature being a bridge between sutra and tantra. And I appreciate to have my tantric experience backed up by Buddha nature teaching.
Mm.
Yeah.
Shall we take the next question?
Yeah, sure. There's also a question more about the Rime masters. Mm-hmm. So this person says, thanks for this fascinating conversation, Klaus Dieter. Could you please say something about how those discourses on Buddha nature in the 14th and 15th century have influenced debates about the relationship between the second and third turnings of the Wheel of Dharma of the Rime masters in the 19th mm-hmm. century? So how did they...
Good question, very good. And it definitely has a great impact on what happened in Eastern Tibet. And we had in the IATS conference in Paris, a panel on Buddha, on Rime, and we are publishing now with Sprill soon a volume. It will come out in September. And we have a few papers on that. And now in what happens in Rime is that you have different groups, so to say, you know, you have on the one hand, you know, you have the Sakya, Nyingma, and Kagyu in the Derge kingdom, with Tsongsa Khyentse, Kongtrul Lodra Taye, and Chokcho Lingpa, and they basically follow taking the third Dharma chakra as Nitata, and also the second, you know, as Nitata, but that requires to reinterpret a little bit Chandrakirti, but you know, then you have this kind of second and third Dharma chakra as Nitata, and you can accommodate also Shentong teachings. And but you know, what I discovered is that the way, you know, Shentong was taught by the Kagyu and by the Nyingma at this time, not all were teaching, of course, Shentong, but the ones who taught. It differs a little bit from the Chonang Shentong, but still, they were kind of accommodating the Chonang path. There were close relations between Palpung Monastery and Samtang in Amdo. The lamas were traveling backward and forward, and they knew each other. They got empowerments and teachings from each other, and somehow the Chonang path were kind of taken into the Rime movement. But still, there are some subtle differences in the way Shentong is explained. I mean, this kind of ultimate, which is beyond space and time, and which is outside of dependent arising, that was something unique to the Chonang path. And that distinction between relative and absolute truth, you know, Gelugpa said, it's two opposite kingdoms. You know, they are not. They are two separate things: relative and absolute truth. And the absolute truth is beyond space and time. It's empty of everything relative. So this is not the way Shantong was explained, for example, by the seventh or the eighth Karma power, by Kong Trul, or by also Shakya Chokden. Like for them, you know, like it's rather that, like you have in Buddha nature, you have like relative and absolute truth, you know, like it's, and like, but the relative truth in Buddha nature is a kind of pure relative truth. It's the Nam Trang Gi Dön Dam also sometimes. It's the, yeah, how you say in English normally, it's the kind of expressible ultimate. And so like, that would be like, or you could also say it's a kind of the pure appearance as such, you know, like without misinterpreting it as subject-object duality. So it's just the pure appearance as such, Nang Tong Yerme, so to say, the emptiness and appearance as such. And but that's relative truth, and that's still part of dependent arising. And, you know, like it's empty of the adventitious stains. That's the imagined nature. And like to some extent also that includes ultimately that which produces the imagined nature, which is the false imagining. But the false imagining is only like transformed in a process of base of fundamental transformation, ashraya paridhiti. So like such that the mind, you know, stops being projecting false things and becomes non-conceptual wisdom. And that's this kind of extended ultimate, which accommodates also a kind of pure relative, which accommodates also dependent arising. That's the basis of negation. And that's empty of other. So like you could say like, like both, you know, the Buddha nature and the adventitious stains, they're both rangtong, yeah. Mm-hmm. But Buddha nature is empty of adventitious stains, of something else. The adventitious stains, they don't belong to the Buddha nature. And so that's why Buddha nature is empty of the adventitious stains. But it doesn't mean that Buddha nature has an inherent existence or exists in terms of its own right necessarily. There is also this view, but there were different types of Shantong. Yeah. One is that Gakshi, the basis of negation, includes also a kind of pure relative. And the other one would be that Gakshi and Gakcha, like the basis of negation and that which is to be negated, are both rangtong. But the Shantong relationship is only between the luminous nature of mind or the Buddha nature and the adventitious stains. And but you know, like in Rime, they downplayed a little bit these differences, you know, they helped each other as a kind of opposition to the Gandhenpotra and to the followers of Chantakirti, and they were not really getting along very well. But you know, there were also other Nyingmapas in the so-called Gemang movement, and they had a kind of Rime understanding between some of the Gelugpas and Dzogchen masters. Mm-hmm. That was also a very important aspect of Rime. So you had different groups, and like the Cholampas, you know, themselves, they had their own connections to the Gelugpas also. So there is a Tsago Geshe, for example, from Amdo. He went to Trepung monastery, or he got a Geshe degree actually. And after he came back, you know, like he wrote texts and he knew very well, all the Gelug interpretation, analytical approach, like to Madhyamaka and the third Dhamma chakra. And he presented everything with the scholarship of a Gelug Geshe. But then, you know, but in a way that it could be used as a stepping stone to his Shantong understanding. And when he comes to ultimate truth, he's 100% Dolpopa. He just presents the Chulang doctrine as Taranatha and Dolpopa. But you know, as a stepping stone to his Chulang understanding, he is using Gelug scholarship. And he was a very respected Kalachakra master. And like the Gelugpas, they came to his Kalachakra retreat to get completion stage instructions on Kalachakra. And at very high ranking Gelugpas, they took tantric teachings from him. And also now, you know, like I was told that in Amdo, like north of Tsamtang, where the center of the Cholangpas is, there is Labrang, you know, these big Gelug monasteries. And they say like sometimes like geishes or lamas from Labrang, they come to get the completion stage instructions on Kalachakra from the Cholangpas. So, you know, like it's not like one thing, you know, Rime. It's very complex. And there have been lots of different interactions.
Yeah, I mean, one of the features of Rime, from how I see it, is that they had that strong sense of inclusivism, isn't it?
Yeah.
That what we had presented from the 14th and 15th century, we have these different interpretations, some that focus and emphasize more of the emptiness part, others of the appearance part, and then that gets passed down and further sort of entrenched into sectarian views. And the Rime movement sort of reacts to that to bring about a more reconciliatory approach, having a very inclusivistic view. And I think it also is really their doxographical thinking of how they don't necessarily see one specific school as the highest and the most ultimate. In fact, most of the Rime masters probably worked in the framework of the nine jhanas. So Prasangika is way down there and not the sort of most ultimate that can't be interpreted. Yeah, and then, as you pointed out, this bifurcation of the ultimate into non-notational, notational, the relative into pure relative and worldly or impure relative. I think they use these hermeneutical tools to bring together differing sort of interpretations from the 14th and 15th century onwards. So
yeah, it's a continuation. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, thank you for the question, Dagmar. The question was from Dagmar, who is also in North America at the moment. So, Carl, as we approach towards the end of our conversation, I want to ask you, if the audience wants to read a book or follow an author, who would you recommend would be the most impressive author to read, or which title would be, or titles would be books you would recommend? Of course, in addition to the online web resource that we have built through the Sada Foundation.
Well, if you manage to read Seyfert React, but unfortunately it's in French, but it's number one scholarship, and you know, like it gives you a very good summary of Gyaltsabche and of Bhutan, and then you know, like well, Takasaki like is giving, you know, like a very good introduction into the Gyulama, into the Ratnakota Vipaka. He has a critical like English annotated translation. Then, you know, like, well, there is Kasu Kano, but you have them, you have these books all on your like list already, isn't it? And
yes, the books are there listed on the website. Some of them may be even available. Especially the primary sources.
Yeah, right. And there is also like the book by Higgins and Raschik and Buddha Nature Reconsidered. And then, you know, like in the book I brought out with Michael Sheehy, with Sunny, there's a lot of Buddha Nature also.
The other emptiness. And,
the other emptiness, exactly. Yeah, and then, you know, like my book on like Gelotsava, the direct path. Yeah, this is also like if you are interested, you know, like in Gelotsava, that's the main source, but it has also a summary of Rangchung Dorje and other masters of his time. Yeah, and then yeah, what else can I recommend? I mean, there are so many books out these days, and but you know, like if I can recommend you, like start by studying like the Tathagatagarbha Sutra and the Ratnakota Vipaka with a good English translation. And there are so many out now already, and you have them on your list, you know, like anyway. And then, you know, like then you get the idea like of like the basic Indian texts. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, like if you are interested in how they have been interpreted by different masters, maybe you don't necessarily like read anymore like a Gyulama commentary. I mean, that's not so much rewarding. Mm-hmm. It's better to somehow read, you know, like a kind of scholastic work, you know, like, for mm-hmm. example, like Tsongkhapa's like Lekshe Ningpo, yeah, like mm-hmm. the distinction between Niyata and Nitata. It's a very rewarding text, like, and you can gain much more insight, you know, like into the Gelug idea of Buddha nature than reading a Gelug commentary on the Gyulama.
Yes, thank you. That's a whole library you're commending. At least for the Ratnakotra Vibhaga, people can go to buddhanature.org and you'll find there the root verses in five different languages. So
I hope fantastic. Yeah, right.
And my final question to you, Klaus, before we close, has your study and your sort of research of Buddha nature shaped your outlook on life, how you view yourself and existence?
It definitely has, you know, like in very practical ways, you know, like just by I got support from the German government for doing research on Buddha nature, things like that. So that changed, you know, like some practical aspects also of my life. So such that I could basically spend all my day, you know, like on reading these texts and like pondering these questions. And yeah, and then, you know, like I think, you know, like it supports like practice. You always think, you know, like, it's useless to study so much, but I can really tell you that like it helps to support your whatever practice you do, you know, like, even if it is not meditating on Buddha nature, if it is just a Yidam practice or whatever, it supports it. And I'm really like it's nice that I had the opportunity in my life, you know, to dedicate so many years in studying this material. And also, you know, like it's nice, you know, to look at discussions and different views, different angles, because, you know, like it opens up your mind, you know, you don't become a dogmatic. Then, you know, like say, okay, you know, like it's a nice idea to have all qualities already in you and you just have to recognize them. It's easy, but then, oh, there are others, you know, who say, oh, be careful, you know, you have to step along a gradual path and it's not, don't take everything for granted. And then you think, maybe they are right, you know, maybe, you know, like there is something to it, you know, like you have to investigate this also, you know, and it's good to look at like the subject matter from different angles and yeah, become also tolerant in a way, yeah, to different approaches. And at some point, maybe you can see like different interpretations of Buddha nature just, you know, like give you different approaches and to more or less the same thing. Of course, no, like you cannot say that like it's the same thing to say Buddha nature is primordially present or it has to be produced, but you know, like the practical like implications, they somehow, you know, like, you have certain periods in your practice where you are more like you're making more effort, or you know, like you try to create some like more concentration or whatever, yeah. And then there are some like phases in your life and your practice where you more relax into Mahamudra or something, you know. So it's nice to kind of switch backward and forward from one to the other. And,
I was just about to let you go, but there is a question that has popped up. Somebody, do you want to take that question?
Yeah, why not? Yeah.
So the question is from Simon. To get from present condition to Buddhahood, even if we accept Buddha nature as being inherent Buddha qualities, practice to develop realization is still essential. The sun is still covered by the clouds and the clouds still needs to be parted. So in this regard, the tradition seems basically the same. Good, yes. Clause,
Definitely. But if the sun has always been there, there's a chance that there's a short gap in the clouds and a shortcut might open up. Yeah, but, right.
Well, thank you very much, Klaus. It was a great pleasure to have you. It's certainly not fair to have you share all your lifelong learning in 1 hour and 20 minutes, and also to try to cover two centuries of Buddha nature scholarship involving maybe some 30 to 40 authors. So we hope we'll be able to bring you back again, that you'll join us again in the future to discuss maybe the 15th century in more detail, maybe the 16th century.
So yeah, that would be fantastic. Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, thank you again for having invited me and having given me a chance to present and share my research. Yeah, that was fantastic. Yeah, thanks for your attention and your interest.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much. And thank you, audience, wherever you are around the world. Have a wonderful day or night.
Okay. Goodbye.